Welcome to Brewing One Ear and Out the Other. I'm Pranav. Our guest on today's podcast is Alyssa, founder and CEO of HipCamp. Just last week, HipCamp closed a $57 million Series C to continue to pursue their mission of getting more people outside and develop a connection to the land. One of the reasons I'm excited to have Alyssa as a guest on Brewing One Ear and Out the Other is because HipCamp is playing a natural and authentic role facilitating dialogue between urban and rural populations, which are often politically disparate. Alyssa is also a kind and humble human being, provides an introspective context of her background and challenges in growing HipCamp. So without further ado, here is our interview with Alyssa. Hi, Alyssa. Thank you for joining us on Brewing One Ear and Out the Other.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Excited as well. Because this is a UCLA themed podcast, one of the things we wanted to do was ask one of the questions that current applicants have to answer as part of the application. As always, we think it will serve as a great introduction for our listeners. The prompt is, what have you done to make your school or community a better place?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think community can be defined on such a small level or a large level. And I think one of the most important things I try to bring to my everyday community, which is my team and my family, is really just about gratitude. I think that that is the most important thing any of us can bring to any situation, a good one or a bad one. And I recently heard this beautiful line from Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's a beautiful indigenous author, that gratitude is our first responsibility as people. And so I think just bringing that mindset as much as I can is of great service to my community. And then on a more tangible physical level, you know, I spend pretty much all day, every day at this point, essentially creating new parks and working with landowners to not only create sustainable income for them to support their incredible farms or ranches or nature preserves, but also to create places for people to get outside and unplug and recharge. I think that is really what our broader community needs right now, you know, more than ever, is the chance to get outside and connect with the great outdoors. So that's what I spend most of my time doing.
I love that. Let's go back to your first community, and I'd argue that was UCLA. How did you end up at UCLA, and what was kind of your early experience there?
So I'm the daughter of two parents who worked in advertising growing up, and so I was lucky to spend time on film sets and production sets early on, and I got the bug and I started making films at a very young age. In fact, I started my first company when I was 9. It was called Spiral Films Production, and my two little sisters were the only employees, and I paid them in mac and cheese. So film was always kind of my guiding light. I've had a long held belief that, you know, my life is going to be best served trying to impact and shape culture, to create a better culture for people and for animals and plants and everything on earth. And so, you know, UCLA was my, it was like literally a post-it on my bulletin board since I was probably 10, in terms of a goal. And my dream was really to go to UCLA and be a film director. That was my intention. And I got into UCLA, which felt amazing. You know, it's such a difficult school to get into now more than ever. It's so competitive and really one of, you know, the best schools in the country. And I felt just so lucky getting in and so excited to be there. And I think that was really my, you know, my first experience at UCLA was just one of gratitude and awe to be amongst so many brilliant people and just all the resources, all the professors in the classes. I was in heaven. I love being a student. So it was incredibly fun.
You created your own major at UCLA. What was kind of the idea or purpose behind creating your own major?
Yeah, well, so you remember I came to UCLA to become a film director, right? I'm half Italian. I'd seen The Godfather, Francis Ford Coppola, in my opinion, had created the best film of all time. And so, of course, I had to go to UCLA like him and become a film director. Well, that plan fell apart when I was a junior because I didn't actually get into the film school. You tend to apply to the film school after being, you know, at UCLA for a year or two. It's a very competitive program. And I actually made it all the way to the final interviews. I'd taken a bunch of classes in the film program. I had some really great relationships with professors there. And so I really felt, you know, not like a shoo-in, but, you know, I should get in. I had great grades. I'd done all the work. I'd done a great application. And I actually ended up really blowing the final interview because I had decided just in the last maybe few weeks preceding the interview that I wanted to study how the internet was going to impact film. And so I used my final interview to kind of try to pitch them on this creative idea, you know, instead of going and actually making films or doing the cinematography aspect of the program, I want to study how film is going to be changed by the internet and how that's going to change distribution and production in our culture. And, you know, the admissions group was very clear that, you know, that wasn't what the program was set up to do. They didn't have that, you know, infrastructure. They didn't have that expertise. And so I walked out of that interview kind of knowing I'd just blown my life dream in 20 minutes, and I wasn't going to get into the film program. And when I kind of got the official word a couple months later, I mean, I was devastated. I'd been building up to this film major again since I was nine, but at UCLA for, you know, nearly three years now in terms of all the classes I'd already taken. And it was actually so bad, I had to go to the UCLA website and click on the page where it lists out all the majors. And I just started at the top. I think it began with anthropology. And I went down one by one and I was like, do I want to study this? Do I want to study this? And nothing really, you know, met what I wanted to study. I had become obsessed with the internet. This was, I think, 2009. And I could just see that it was going to change everything. And that was all I wanted to study. And then finally, at the very bottom, I saw this little asterisk and it said individual studies. And I was like, ooh, that feels like where I'm at in life right now. And so I, you know, made an appointment, met up with the department that handled that. And it was just, it was incredible. You know, the fact that a school so big and so impressive as UCLA can still have a department for, you know, misfit toys like me that are just convinced they need to, you know, forge their own path and create their own study was incredible. And so I got the major approved. It was focused on the internet, no surprise. And it was called Digital Democracy. And the concept was that the internet was going to radically democratize access to everything, government, media, business, capital. And I actually ended up writing my thesis on how the internet was going to really change journalism. And I have a deep passion for journalism and, you know, fair, deep investigative journalism. And it was a pretty depressing major to write because I could kind of see that as the internet started taking over the media, newspapers were going to go out of business, and it was probably going to be a while till people figured out, you know, a new business model that really mapped to the internet properly. So it was a really great experience. And I'm just so grateful that I had the opportunity to do that. I wish everyone could do that. It's an incredibly fun way to experience an institution like UCLA.
I heard one of the amazing experiences that you had at UCLA was your study abroad experience in Barcelona. How did you end up going to Barcelona? What was your experience like there?
Yeah, going abroad was a pretty last minute decision for me. I think I decided in the final week, and my friend and I decided Barcelona sounded like the most fun. I also think as someone who grew up in California and lives in California today, the ability to speak Spanish is such a, you know, daily, if not weekly, skill set. And so it just seemed like a good idea to go somewhere where I could really build up competency in a language that I plan to use. And it was an incredible experience. I think I was a okay student. And I think I learned a lot about culture and socializing. And just, you know, I think it was really my first time living outside of the United States for a while. And so getting to talk to people who, you know, grew up in Spain and hearing their perspective on the United States was very mind-opening for me. And I was actually lucky enough to be there when we elected President Obama. And so getting to just really understand how much the American presidency is watched globally and is anticipated. And, you know, I got to go to Morocco while I was in Spain, because they're not too far apart, and walking through these, you know, villages and in the desert, and even the little kids there would run up to you. This is in the weeks right before the election, and they would ask, Obama or McCain, you know, who do you support? And they want to know. And when you said Obama, they'd all cheer, right? And so I think, you know, getting to see that perspective, getting to be there for the win, getting to see how much United States really does influence and impact globally, really, it shifted how I thought about the world in a really, really valuable and important way.
And was that part of the reason, I guess, you ended up interning for the U.S. Department of State?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, the Department of State was kind of this perfect storm where I created this major called digital democracy. And I knew I wanted to go do the UCDC program, which was, I think is, I hope it's still going. It's an incredible program where they actually give you like a dorm and a place to live in Washington, D.C., just a few blocks from the White House, and help you connect with, you know, potential internships. And, you know, the State Department at the time was really taking, under the leadership of President Obama, a digital first approach to a lot of their diplomacy efforts. And so when they saw my major was called digital democracy, they were just like, get in here, this is perfect. And, you know, that was, I haven't actually had like that many jobs in my life, but that was my favorite for sure. It was just so fun to be part of that conversation. And really with the internet in particular, there's not really that much unified global policy yet. And so to be working on policy in a sector where, you know, you're not just trying to fight bad policy, but really imagine what could great policy look like. That was an incredible opportunity, and I got to work with some incredible people. So very grateful for that.
After your internship, after graduating UCLA, what's your outlook like on in terms of jobs that you want to go into or long-term career?
Yeah, after submitting my thesis and getting that, you know, I've completed my major email. You know, I actually, let's see, I'd helped start a startup the summer before. So part of kind of being obsessed with the internet meant that San Francisco and the incredible, you know, black hole that happens here, and especially, you know, back then was really only happening here. Back then, that's changed quite a bit, but back in 2009, you know, this is where it was all happening. So I'd come home for the summer and helped a couple of friends start a little startup. We used iPads as cash registers. This is before Square, by the way. And so coming out of the State Department internship, I just knew I wanted to build something. I knew I wanted to create something that didn't exist yet. And so I started working on that company right away. And I think I made like $20,000 a year, but I had a lot of fun and I learned a lot. And it really kind of set me up for a career in this weird and wild world of, you know, building new products and creating new companies out of nothing.
Yeah. Out of personal curiosity, when you applied to the UCLA film school, you talked about kind of how the internet would affect film. You come back to the Bay Area, Netflix is down here in Los Gatos. And I think in 2009, there's still majority DVD by mail. Did you ever apply to Netflix or were they on your radar?
They were totally on my radar. I mean, when they, the day that they, because I also worked in Hollywood, right? I actually interned at a couple film production companies and really kind of started to understand how that industry worked. And I knew, you know, they hate Netflix, those big studios. And the day that Netflix announced they were, you know, splitting their DVD membership and their streaming membership, which to me made perfect sense.
Yeah.
The media freaked out, right? Because it was a good chance to pick on someone they didn't like anyway. And the stock price tanked. And I will say, I told my parents to buy a lot of stock that day, which they did. Mm-hmm. But I never thought about going to work there because, I don't know, I guess I just always wanted to start something new. Again, I think we're all really lucky to be alive during this really, I mean, look, it's a hard time. This year is a hard year. And I think there's some more, I don't think the rest of the 2020s are going to be a cakewalk, but you know, I think this is a really powerful time to be alive because so much of how we've built our culture and our society is getting called into question. And we need to rethink how our systems work and our government works and our economy works and how our, you know, agriculture works and how our recreation works. And so I don't know, I've always wanted to be at the forefront of that, seeing what's new and helping to shape it.
On that topic of just 2020 being a hard year, I think, you know, 2012 might have been a hard year for you personally. You were unemployed, you were traveling around India for a while. How do you kind of overcome that personal adversity?
Yeah, I mean, I think in 2012, I got fired twice from the same job. So it was a hard year.
Wow.
That is possible to do. If you haven't done it, it's doable. I did it. So that was really hard and really had, you know, led me to question things like, am I employable? You know, so that was definitely tough. You know, I think for me, challenges and hard times, if you approach them with the right mindset, just always lead to the best thing later. Like, the worst things always become the best thing, in my opinion. And you just have to approach it with the right mindset so you can kind of get the learnings and get the information from it. And so, you know, for me, the biggest learning out of all of that, because by the way, the day that I got fired the second time, I also got dumped. True story, same morning.
Oh, wow.
So it was like a really hard time. But for me, what I got to take from all of that was this incredible sense of, you know, renewed clarity on, like, I'm in charge of my happiness. I can't rely on my job, on my partner, really on anyone else to make me happy. Like, I need to prioritize that. And I think that was really an important foundation to have, you know, going into starting Hip Camp, which I did, you know, a few months later, because so many people at the time were like, a camping website? Like, Jenny, you go like work at Uber or something, you know? And I was like, you know, this makes me happy. I think it's really important and I'm just going to keep doing it. And that ended up, you know, working out, you know, way better than I could have ever, you know, imagined, really. And so I think having that, you know, desire to really prioritize happiness was a really important foundation to have going into starting a company. And I'll also say, though, I think in terms of personal adversity, and I think this is a really important part of entrepreneurship that we should talk about more, I am an incredibly privileged individual. My parents are still together. They own a home just 30 minutes away from San Francisco. I am welcome to live there whenever I need to. And so for me, while being unemployed was a bit of a bruise to the ego, I never had to worry about where I was going to sleep or what I was going to eat or, you know, anything truly threatening to my well-being. And I think that that level of privilege is actually a huge part of why I was able to start the company, right? I was the one who was able to go down to having, you know, more money owed on my credit card than in my bank account, because I knew that my parents were there and if things got really bad, I would just start, you know, working some random job and it would be fine. And so I think actually, while overcoming adversity is, I think, part of any entrepreneurial journey, and there are many entrepreneurs who have overcome incredible amounts of adversity, I think there's also a bit of a pattern around many entrepreneurs coming from a place of privilege where they're able to take that risk. And I just think that's important to acknowledge.
No, thank you for providing that context. So kind of what led you to leave the US and travel around India for a while? And what was that experience like?
It was incredible. I almost didn't go because I felt so guilty, right? Like, who am I to be unemployed and traveling? But I also knew that I didn't know when I was going to get to do it again. And I'm glad I did, because here I am 7 years later, 8 years later. Oh my gosh, 8 years later. And I haven't had another opportunity like that to just go wander the earth for a few months. So I'm glad I did it. And I think I just kind of knew that these moments in life are precious and rare. And if you're lucky enough to be able to travel, you should, because when I travel, when I get to go experience a new culture and be in the minority, and India in particular, I just love, there's so much color and passion and love in that culture. And you just, it just sweeps you away. I love the chaos. I love the energy. I love, just how welcoming and encouraging all the people are. And so I think, like, having that experience and getting to just go be lost there for a while You know, it sounds cheesy, but it helped me realize like who I wanted to be. You know, I don't want to be someone who is so worried about work all the time that they forget to stop and have a delicious dinner with their family. I don't want to be that person. And I think travel, you know, helps you try on new people and figure out who you want to be. And so, again, I think my biggest learning from all of that travel was really, I have to own my happiness. I cannot keep asking others to take care of that for me. And, you know, I think that, that has served me well. And even just saying it to you is helping me remember to keep doing that.
There's a class at UCLA Anderson that Professor Cassie Mogilner-Holmes teaches, and it's all about happiness, which I'm really glad that Anderson has like these classes that you normally wouldn't expect a business school to have about sustainability or happiness, social impact topics as well.
Yeah, an absolutely big shout out to Anderson, by the way, because when I was an undergrad creating this major, part of the magic of creating a major is every quarter, you know, you see the courses get published. And I would go like drop in. I didn't have a PTE enrollment number, so I actually had a hard time getting into any class because I didn't have an official department, so no one could give me an enrollment, early enrollment number. So what I had to do was I had to just go to all these classes the first week and then decide which ones I liked and then try to talk my way into them. That was what I did every quarter. And so as part of that, as someone who had aspirations to, you know, start companies in the internet space, I went to Anderson and I got to talk my way into a few incredible business classes. I took a class on complexity science and management science. I took a class with Gigi Johnson on new media. She was probably the most kind of cutting edge and connected professor on the internet. And she was teaching this incredible class at Anderson all about Netflix and Google and Facebook and what was happening. I got to take a seminar series. It was a collaboration between the film school and the business school where they brought in, you know, Arianna Huffington and the founder of YouTube and just these incredible internet entrepreneurs. And so the Anderson school is actually a big part of my undergrad education. And I feel just super fortunate I got to have that experience.
That's amazing. And I just want to let you know that when you're talking about all these amazing entrepreneurs that you got to hear from, I'm sure, you know, anytime you go back on campus to Anderson, there's going to be a current student body saying that about you as well.
Very kind of you to say, thank you.
Back to kind of realizing that happiness is something that comes personally or from within. You come back to the US from India and you sign up for a coding boot camp. Why coding and kind of where were you then?
Yeah, well, the other half of that story is before I went to India, before I was crazy enough to do that, I actually tried to get into the coding school by showing up at day one of the classes and just saying, hey, I just learned about this over the weekend. I submitted my application. You probably haven't read it yet, but you should let me in. And God bless them. They were incredibly sweet and heard me out all morning and then were like, no, that's not fair to all the other students. We can't do that. But if you want to join the next session, you can. And so that's part of how I ended up with this weird like 3 month chunk of like, what am I going to do with my life? Mm-hmm. And so coming back from India and actually being in India a lot, I kept wondering like, should I go do this coding boot camp? I don't know that I am going to love coding, but I was doing it because I knew I wanted to start a company in the internet. I knew that that was what I wanted to do. And I just couldn't shake this feeling that to do that well, I should know more about how the internet works and how to really use that tool to create and to build. And so coming back home and, you know, I actually had the idea for Hip Camp right when I got home from India, which I haven't connected. That was probably part of why I actually had the idea, because I'd taken time off and I'd really kind of opened up my mind to new possibilities and was just really, you know, in a great headspace. So I came home from India. I decided to go camping. That wonderful man who broke up with me, who's now my fiance, by the way, I wanted to take him camping. And so I planned out this trip for us. And it was through that planning process that I realized how broken, you know, this whole system was and how fragmented all the information was. And I almost gave up, but I really wanted to take him camping. He's from Sydney, Australia. He like really hadn't spent that much time in the outdoors. And I needed him to know how beautiful California was. And, you know, I eventually found us a campground and we drove down and I showed up and found out that it had an amazing surf break. And I had taken my surfboard out of my car before driving down, and I love to surf. And it was just such a frustrating moment because I'd done hours of research and no one had mentioned the surf break. And so the idea for Hip Camp actually just came the next morning when I was driving home, where I suddenly realized that this whole process of getting outside was broken and it was a great problem for the internet to fix. And so that all happened just a few weeks before the coding bootcamp started. And so when I started the bootcamp, just had this idea in the back of my head where I was like, should I just go build this camping website? Like, I want to use it. Maybe other people will too. I'm not sure. And so going through the program, I would say my biggest surprise was how much I loved coding. I didn't really expect to love it. I just thought it was the next step or the thing I needed to do. And so I did almost decide to go get a job. I didn't have a great track record with jobs, but I was like, maybe this is the time and I should go be an engineer. And I feel really fortunate that Steve Huffman, who co-founded Reddit, as well as HipMunk, came as a guest speaker to one of the last classes of this program, this Dev Bootcamp program, which was an amazing program, by the way. It's no longer running, but it was such an incredible program because they built in, you know, daily yoga classes and engineering empathy, where you learn skills around, you know, dealing with your emotional response to, you know, essentially what coding is feeling stupid all day and being okay with it. So they did a great job really educating the whole person. And Steve Huffman came in and I asked him, I said, hey, I just learning how to code and I really like it. Do you think I should go be an engineer or should I go build this idea that I have? And I didn't pitch him on the idea. I just asked a question like that. And he said, well, you know, does the idea solve a problem that you personally have experienced? And I was like, absolutely. That's how I got the idea. And he was like, okay. And does the idea address a problem that other people have too? And I said, oh yeah, my friends who actually, you know, boat camping more often than I do, every time I tell them about this, they're like, oh my gosh, yes, camping's broken, fix it. He was like, okay. And would people pay you if you could solve this problem for them? And I thought back to my experience trying to find a campsite for my, you know, my boyfriend, and I was broke, as you know, and unemployed. And I was like, wow, I think even my unemployed ass would have paid like $20 to have somebody like just solve the problem for me back then. And so I said, yeah, I think people would pay for this. And he said, yes, 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 do it. Don't look back. Even if you totally fail, you will learn something about yourself, about the world, about the market, and you'll be better for it. And I just think that framework, I repeat it as often as I can, because I think so many people out there are, you know, they've got these ideas and they're always on the edge of, should I do it? Should I not do it? And while it's a deeply personal decision, that again, so much of it comes back to your, you know, your financial position and the risks you can afford to take. But if you have an idea that fits that framework, I think, you know, if you can, it's always great to at least try.
So you decided to move forward with building Hip Camp. When did you realize you were onto something?
I think I realized I was onto something. You know, it probably took a few months. I would say the first few months I was solo founding. My little sisters and my best friend Natalie helped like source photos and content and write up all these things. And we just cobbled together this little website. And I thought it was going to be a smashing success. You know, I launched it in June 8th and I was like, this is going to take off for the summer. And then like nobody used it for 2 months and I was devastated. you know, I think towards the end of August, so 3 months into kind of launch, one person booked a campsite. And I think I knew I was onto something when that one person booked. It really just took one person to like trust the website. And back then it was really cool. You could book public camping on Hip Camp. We were an aggregator of public campgrounds back then. And then I would get a text message and then I would go actually book it for you. And I did that and it worked. And I think that was when I really knew we were onto something that people wanted. And then I think, you know, what was hard for the company and really honestly for the next 2 or 3 years was that, you know, accessing public camping reservations was just nearly impossible. They were at the time almost entirely wrapped up in contracts with a single big billion-dollar corporation called Reserve America, which is owned by the Active Network, or was. And they had all these contracts locked up. And so I tried to partner with them. I tried to say, hey, I'm building this website. I'm going to send you new traffic. You're going to get more bookings. I know you make $10 a booking. Can I have one of those $10? And they were like, no, we're the only place you can book Yosemite. Like, don't you understand? Why would we share with you? And we actually eventually had to launch a massive coalition of nonprofits and organizations like REI and the Sierra Club to basically lobby the government to make open data the standard for our public lands. And we succeeded in doing that. And I was really proud and am really proud of that win. But, you know, through all of that, we're all the way up to 2015 now, almost 2016. I still didn't know if I was going to have a profitable company because, you know, it didn't, with the government in particular, even with this open data precedent, you know, who knows how long that's going to take. And I raised some money, but not that much. I couldn't wait for years or anything. And so I think that the moment where I knew we were going to have a company that, you know, could be a lasting company was actually years later when we started working with private landowners. And when I realized that, you know, there are so many people who own land, who want to share it, who want others to experience, you know, the incredible beauty and who could really benefit from some income. And once I really understood how much of that land there was and how much demand there was for just places to get outside, especially places that are private and unique, personal, that was when I knew we really could build a business here. Before that, it just felt like a cool product. And I love building products, but that was really when it felt like we became a business.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, if we're looking at the US, the differences between private and public land and how it kind of breaks out?
Yeah, I mean, the history, land is potentially one of the most fascinating things to learn about. And, you know, no matter where you live, I would say the first thing you should do is learn about on whom's homelands, on which indigenous tribes' homelands you're living and working, and start building a relationship there, because the history of land in this country is very complicated. And there's a lot of promises and treaties that we have in paper that we signed that we've broken as a country. And so I think really understanding that historical context is critical to really understanding how land works in this country and who has land and who doesn't and how did that happen. And so, you know, I think in the US you have quite a bit of public land, you know, compared to somewhere like Europe, for example. We actually are very, very fortunate in terms of the amount and the beauty and the grandeur of our public land, which is incredible. But, you know, we also have a bit of a problem where our public park agencies are just chronically underfunded. They should be getting a lot more money from our taxes, in my opinion, to run their parks, to build their parks, and to build new parks. This year, Gavin Newsom added a new state park campground, which is the first time that had happened in a long time. And it's just crazy because the population in California has grown tremendously and we haven't been building more parks and we haven't been building more campsites. And so what's happened to public land over time is there's just, you know, a lot more demand than supply and it gets loved to death. It gets overutilized. And, you know, you probably know if you like to camp that many campsites, it's 7 a.m. the day the reservation opens, you got to be online ready to click, you know, book now, or you're not going to get to go. And so, you know, I think that's really the context in which we started the company. And like I said, we focused on public land for quite a few years and we built a great product to explore publicly. And we were actually the first product where you could see your state parks and your national parks and your county parks all in one map, which people loved. But everything was booked up. And they kept telling us that, and we kept getting that feedback. And I spent a long time actually lobbying the public park agencies to build more campgrounds, only to find out they were actually shutting them down due to lack of funding. And that was really when I started to kind of connect the dots, because I was like, wait, there's so many more people who want to go visit parks and there are places to visit, but they're closing them down because of lack of funding. That feels like a problem we should really be able to solve. And so, you know, private land, emerged really by private landowners reaching out to me. I wasn't the genius who said, ooh, let's bring the sharing economy to land. I was the woman with a camping website who other landowners kind of saw the opportunity in. And so as landowners started to reach out to us, we really, you know, started to realize there was an opportunity there. And the private land in this country is amazing as well. It's beautiful. The majority of the country is privately owned. And so there's just, you know, so much of it. And I think, you know, from a recreation standpoint, it's really important because especially if you look at one of the biggest trends of the last, you know, few decades, it's urbanization. People are moving to cities at a really quick rate. And so especially the public lands within, you know, weekend striking distance of these bigger cities are just so over demanded. And so all these private lands that are also kind of near and around these urban areas, they have a huge opportunity to earn some extra income and in many cases provide a really needed release valve for these poor people who are trapped in cities to kind of find some stars and fresh air and some space. And so we really just started connecting those dots, and it wasn't obvious at first. I grew up camping in state parks and national parks, so I didn't, you know, right away realize how amazing private land could be, but it's incredible. And from an environmental standpoint, you know, if you're a bird or a frog or the river, you don't know what's public or private. And so I think kind of working together between public and private landowners to create, you know, holistic land management plans and figure out how to repair a river and a watershed, that's the conversation we need to be having. And it's exciting to be part of that community.
You can say that last part again. Last week in our backyard, I was hearing like these really loud noises and I had no clue what it was. And I just opened the blinds, turned on the light, and there was a giant opossum just looking me in the eye. And I was like, yeah, this guy does not know the difference between public land and private land. And people who know me know I'm scared of squirrels. So I was scared. And I'm at home because of COVID, and I just yelled for my mom and she came down. But yeah, so he's been coming for the last week and a half. And now that I know we have an opossum, I'm getting used to it. But sounds like HipCamp is almost like a wealth distribution system for people who live in cities and those who kind of live in rural areas. Kind of as we saw with kind of the election, we're seeing kind of a chasm where, you know, people who live in cities, it's a lot more blue, more Democrats, and people who live away from cities in rural areas, a bit more conservative. Kind of how do you see HipCamp at this intersection?
Yeah, that's a fascinating and really insightful question. We often talk about red states and blue states, but to your point, just if you go zoom in on the data, that is completely false. Pretty much every city in America, even in the reddest states you can imagine, is blue. And pretty much every really rural county, even in the bluest state you can imagine, is red. And so for HipCamp, you know, building community across that urban rural divide is not necessarily something we set out to do, but is very much something that we are doing every day, many times a day, thousands of times a day. And so I think, you know, what's been fascinating for me as someone who grew up in a very liberal part of the world, it's been really interesting to spend a lot of time with people who are more conservative. And I think my big takeaway from all of it personally, which has really informed how the company approaches this, you know, opportunity and challenge, is that we actually agree on most things. There's actually not that many topics on which, you know, people really disagree. And I think what's great about being an outdoors company is that it's probably the least controversial topic I can think of. Everybody, whether you're Republican or Democrat or independent, everybody wants to leave a clean soil, clean water, and better future for their children. It's just a shared natural instinct that I think, you know, almost every person I've ever spoken to has. And so, you know, as a company, we really view our opportunity from a cultural standpoint as one of getting to bridge communities and worlds that don't often get to come together by really staying focused on that incredible, you know, shared set of values, because it's actually really big. If you agree that we should take good care of the land and you agree we should leave it better than we found it, it's amazing how much there is there in terms of policy, in terms of politics, in terms of culture and values. And I think that it's really a shame that there hasn't been as much kind of shared community around that topic. And instead we end up getting divided on these other lines that serve other political parties or other, you know, big companies to really divide us on, when really we agree on almost all of the big important things. And so as a company, I think we really try to teach our team and our community and ourselves to stay focused on having empathy, stay focused on having openness to new opportunities. We do have a really thoughtful inclusion policy where we make sure that, you know, despite political differences, people are still going to feel safe and welcome wherever they go. That's really, really important to us and core to what we do. And so I think it's always a learning process, but we've gotten to hear, you know, so many amazing stories. So many of our first reviews, I remember reading through and seeing these people from cities saying, you know, I had no idea farmers were so smart. And it's so funny how in this country we've really, like, you know, taken these incredible, to me, farmers are heroes. You know, these people feed us, and it is not easy. And it takes an incredible amount of intelligence and intuition and connection to the land. And yet as a culture, we've you know, kind of written them off in so many ways as not smart. Like, when did that happen? Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, we've heard from, you know, a lot of our hosts who, you know, really aren't so sure about these city people and their Teslas and with their, you know, fluid genders and, you know, just interesting and in many ways in their eyes, kind of these radical lifestyles. But then they meet these people. And I remember a host actually wrote me that his dad has been fundamentally changed by hosting on Hip Camp, because he keeps meeting these people who, you know, map to these identities that he thinks are going to be, you know, crazy, quote unquote, liberals. But then he's always so surprised by their character and their values and just how much that they also care about the land. And so I think it sounds kind of cheesy maybe, but the land, it does serve as this incredible common ground with the ability to bring people together who otherwise would probably never meet and certainly would have a hard time finding, you know, something they share. But when our hosts and our hip campers come together, they immediately have a shared love for the land. That's why they're both there. And that's how the conversation and relationship get to begin.
Wow, that's really amazing to see this environmental stewardship kind of be a shared value across. So Will Smith and Jay-Z are investors. Kind of, how did that end up happening and how cool is that?
It's super cool, I'm not going to lie. I am a, I'm really a lifelong fan of both of their music. I think I listened to Millennium probably 1,000 times, but Jay-Z's music in particular has been just really influential, especially in my entrepreneurial pursuits, because as I grew up, you know, here in California, and I think this is something that a lot of people can relate to, but probably especially people who identify as female, there's a lot of pressure and expectation put on you to make other people happy and serve others and really just go along to get along and don't cause problems and don't be difficult and always above all, make sure that everyone thinks well of you and really optimize around what people think of you. And Jay-Z's lyrics to me were like this incredible, reprogramming, if you will, of just like, I don't care about my critics. I don't care at all. I'm going to do whatever I want because I know that I'm thinking deeply about what I'm doing and I'm going to do what I think is right. And so I've got, you know, notebooks, tons of my notebooks from college actually have Jay-Z lyrics just written all over them. And so to get them to invest in the company and really see the value of the outdoors and really kind of be part of this moment, this cultural moment of saying, you know, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you look like the outdoors is for everybody, not just the classic outdoors person that you see on the billboards with their big beard and their flannel and their ice pick. Like, no, the outdoors is for everybody. And that's just so core to our mission and what we're doing at Hip Camp, that having them join as investors was a big dream, and was really, you know, exciting when it finally came true.
That's amazing. What are your personal kind of favorite spots? Maybe if we had to pick two places in the Bay Area and in LA area.
Ooh, that is a really, that is a really good one. Let's see, outside of LA, there is there's a place called Sky Farm Yurt. It's actually only like 10 or 20 minutes outside of town, but it's just such a such an incredible escape, and somewhere that's, you know, one of those places that's, you know, so close to the city, but feels so far away. And then there's also this place, it's a little bit further away, but it's incredible. It's called Angela's Crest Creamery.
Okay.
And you can go tent or RV camp. You can stay in an Airstream. It's 70 acres and it's actually in the Angeles National Forest. So you've really got kind of a big space to roam and explore. And that's an incredible place to visit too. And then, gosh, here around the Bay Area, I love Oz Farm. It's up north on the coast a bit. It's a former hippie commune that's now run by an incredible group of people who deeply care about regenerative agriculture and organic agriculture and are trying to rebuild the food system, and I think doing a great job at it. And there's probably, I think it's like 10 or so just like unique cabins that were each hand built in the 70s by these different math professors who were building this commune together. And so you can stay in those, you can tent camp, you can RV camp. And they've just got a beautiful, you know, communal kitchen, hot tub, library, pizza oven. Like it's just, you know, you get your box of produce at your cabin when you show up if you want. So they always provide an incredible sanctuary. And then I also really like Salmon Creek Ranch. It's less than an hour from the city, but again, I think it's 100 acres or so of big old growth redwoods. And you can just go find a little campsite and tuck away in the redwoods by the creek and have an incredibly quiet and relaxing weekend. So those are a few of my favorite. It's hard to just pick a few, but.
Yeah, so for our listeners, many of whom are in finals week today till Friday, if they book Oz Farm, they're not going to run into a math professor from UCLA, will they?
No more math professors. I don't know. I shouldn't say that, but no more. Not the ones who at least built all the cabins. That was back in the 70s. But you know, it's a good place to study, maybe.
Now you guys are expanding outside of the U.S. as well. I know you mentioned your fiance is from Sydney, Australia, and you guys just acquired U Camp out in Australia. Why was kind of maybe Australia your first spot for international expansion, and how does kind of camping translate overseas?
Yeah, you know, I think Australia, one, is a place that I've had the fortune of getting to visit quite a bit. So it's just a really beautiful country with a great culture of the outdoors. And as a company that has, you know, big goals for expanding around the whole world and really creating a global community of people who love the land and take care of the land, Australia is extra attractive because Australians travel everywhere. And so I feel like if you win the Australian market, you like win the global travel market, because they just go everywhere and they're like the nicest people and everybody loves them, and they talk and they'll help spread the word. And so that was kind of part of the strategy, I would say, was just they're such an important community that again really prioritizes this. You know, it's not uncommon as an Australian to take a year or two off and just travel. I think we could probably stand to learn a bit from them in America. And I would say the other thing that was really cool for us about Australia was that they're counter seasonal. So here in the US, obviously more people want to go camping in July than January. But in Australia, it's the exact opposite. And so it was a really nice way for us to balance out, you know, like we've got this incredible support team. And in the summer, they were always like totally overworked. And in the winter, they were like, we're not always sure what we need to do right now. And they'll find great projects to work on, but you know, it's not ideal. And now that we're kind of on both both sides of the equator. It's just a nice way to balance out kind of some of the demand. And then finally, you know, the UCAMP team, really, the people who had built that company who now, you know, are leading that country for HipCamp are just incredible people. And they had accomplished so much with so little resources, and it was just so impressive. They actually started doing camping on private land 3 years before we did. They were actually way ahead of us in a lot of ways, and started their company because they were landowners who started to have people come camp on their land all the time and realize the opportunity from the landowner perspective. And so just getting to bring in that perspective and that level of talent and, you know, also expand into a really valuable market was a no-brainer. And I feel really excited that it's, you know, we're still just getting started, to be honest.
And as you guys are still just getting started, maybe what advice would you have for other entrepreneurs, Bruin founders, or female founders, so they can kind of achieve the same level of success that you
say? A few things. I mean, one, with choosing what specific idea to really go after, I really think Steve Huffman's advice was the best. You know, is it a problem you've experienced? Because it's hard to solve a problem you've never experienced. Right. So it's better when you can really be your own first customer. Do other people have that problem? Make sure you're not a customer of one. And then would people pay you if you solved it? Like, if you have an idea that really is a solid yes to each of those three questions, I think, you know, it's an incredible opportunity if you're able to go for it. And then I think once you decide to start, for me, I think one of the most important things has been always just working with our community and really, you know, asking our customers, what do you want? What do you think we should build next? And really kind of viewing the creation of something brand new, like viewing that as a collaborative process where we're really getting to co-create together. That's kind of where all of our best ideas come from, especially now from our hosts, who are basically, you know, these incredible entrepreneurs building on top of this platform that we created. They have so many of the best ideas now, and we just need to listen a lot of the time. So I think listening is really important. And then, you know, I think probably my biggest mistake, or like the thing that I, you know, I would do differently if I ever decided to do this again, would be just to take better care of my body. I think there's something in our culture that makes you think that if you, you know, stay up till 1 a.m. and, you know, eat crappy food and work super hard on your computer all the time, like, that's what it takes. And while I think, you know, without debate, there's periods of time as an entrepreneur that are going to require just an insane level of sustained effort, there's very little to gain, in my experience, by not sleeping and by not exercising. And I kind of had to learn that one the hard way. Drove myself into the ground a little bit, which is quite ironic since I was building a brand around taking care of yourself in the outdoors. And I actually think we would have gotten further faster if I had just been a little bit more long-term thinking there. So I think that is super important advice. And I think if as a female founder, you know, I get this question a lot. And on one hand, I want to just say, hey, don't worry about it. You know, don't overthink it. On the other hand, there has been a lot of moments where it's just, you know, I think it probably has been harder. I remember going to this, you know, the first big outdoor industry conference I ever went to, where everybody assumed my male employee was the CEO of the company, everybody. And it was hard. It was just like, ouch, like, I guess these people don't, you know, see me as a CEO. So, you know, I think the thing that I come back to when just hard, shitty stuff happens like that is just remembering that, you know, I'm not just doing this for me. I'm like helping make it better for whoever comes next, because I just corrected that person and said, actually, I'm the CEO. And I got to watch their face go like, oh shit. And that was a good moment. They're going to not probably do that again. And so just remembering that you're part of this long chain of people, and you're not, you know, you're part of it, and you're helping to move things forward, just like so many people have helped move things forward before you. I think that helps me find a lot of purpose in my harder moments as a female founder. I like being able to change people's mind and push boundaries. And then finally, I think in terms of, you know, raising capital and in many ways just being a founder, you know, what you really want to do is be able to stand out. And so I'm not saying it's easier as a female founder, but I'm saying there is an advantage there sometimes if you can think about how to use that, because you are, you're the minority, and that's interesting. And people remember that. So that's at least what I tell myself to help make everything feel easier, as I think it's an advantage. So
thanks for being really vulnerable and sharing that. One of our final two questions, what was your favorite UCLA memory, and who's your favorite UCLA Bruin?
There are so many UCLA memories I'm like really enjoying sorting through some of them. I mean, these are like the small ones, but they're the ones that really stand out to me. Bruin Cafe at 11 p.m. was just the best. Like, I just loved having so many friends in such close proximity and being able to have, you know, such an incredible, supportive, interesting, brilliant community. I think that's what's so interesting about UCLA is everyone's so smart and so interesting. And I just loved having those late nights where you just have the most incredible, you know, conversations and moments together. That those are the little things, for sure, but they really add up. And I think, you know, the moment that probably really stands out to me is one of my favorite moments was the moment that I was told that my proposal for my major was going to happen, and that I was going to get to go, you know, study the internet and really utilize this incredible institution for all of its knowledge and really spend the next 2 years, year and a half, you know, really focused on that. And that moment really just meant everything to me. It was so validating. It was so exciting. And yeah, I would say that was my favorite memory. And then my favorite Bruin, there's so many. Obviously Francis Ford Coppola is the person who kind of I followed to UCLA. Mm-hmm. So he's got to be up there. And then Eleanor Ostrom, I think, is really just one of my all-time favorite thinkers. She won, you know, the Nobel Prize for essentially proving that communities under the right set of conditions are able to self-govern and are able to take care of natural resources without needing to have fences and private property. And, you know, I took political science at UCLA, and there's incredible learnings in all those classes. But I remember learning about the tragedy of the commons, which is essentially, you know, why we need fences, because we can't trust each other to like communally share resources. And I remember thinking that sounded like kind of a bummer, and her work proved that that's actually not true. And then in many communities, they do share the commons, and it does work out. And I think in our current moment in time where, you know, income disparity is spiking so dramatically, and our economy in many ways is really leaving the majority of our population behind. I think it's time for big thinking and big ideas on how we are gonna govern ourselves and our resources and our community. And I think her work is, an incredibly important part of the future that we're just starting to understand. And then shout out to Annalee Fisher, the first mother in space. I think she's been on my laptop background for many years on and off, and is a big hero as well. So
both amazing Bruins. Thank you so much for joining us on Bruin 1 Year and Out the Other. And finally, before we let you go, feel free to give us a 30-second plug for Hip Camp or, you know, something going on in your life.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give a plug for Hip Camp. So we are a amazing community of people who love to get outside. And if you are a landowner or you know someone who owns land and they might want to share it or earn some extra income, there's an incredible financial opportunity for them to not only earn some money, but get people outside and be part of that movement to reconnect people with nature. So go to hipcamp.com. You can sign up there. We've got a great team who can help teach you how to succeed in setting up a camp. And it's also a great place to find your next outdoor adventure. So come check it out.
Thanks again to Alyssa for joining us on the podcast. And like always, hopefully everything we talked about today didn't go Bruin one ear and out the other.